From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Frankly, he wanted to do things not necessarily tougher than me. You know, John's known as a tough guy. He's so tough he got us into Iraq. That's tough.
As President Trump ousts his hawkish national security advisor, John Bolton, we'll look at what it means for U.S. relations with Iran, North Korea, as well as the war in Afghanistan. Then Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vows to annex a third of the occupied West Bank. The move has been denounced around the globe, but not in Washington.
What Prime Minister Netanyahu said tonight about asking his people for a mandate to allow that will enable him to annex the Jordan Valley is paramount to a war crime.
And we go to Newark, New Jersey, where thousands of residents remain unable to drink their tap water due to lead contamination in an enduring public health nightmare. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Bahamas, authorities have published a list of 2,500 people who went missing after Hurricane Dorian ravaged the island nation in early September as a Category 5 storm. The official death toll stands at 50, but Prime Minister Hubert Minnis warned Wednesday the number is likely to soar. Compounding the Bahamas' misery is a massive oil spill that's begun to spread into the ocean off the southern coast of Grand Bahama Island after Hurricane Dorian blew the lids off six giant crude oil tanks. This comes as multiple news outlets reported the Trump administration has decided not to grant temporary protected status to Bahamians, which would allow them to work and live in the United States until it's safe for them to return home. In response, the National Immigration Law Center tweeted, for the Trump administration to deny TPS to those seeking shelter is yet another example of their sheer cruelty, they said. On Wednesday, the Miami Herald reported a 12-year-old Bahamian girl whose home was destroyed by the hurricane was separated from her family by U.S. authorities after arriving in South Florida. The girl, Keitora Paul, had arrived with her godmother at an airport in West Palm Beach and was taken into the custody of the Health and Human Services Department and moved to a facility for unaccompanied immigrant children in Miami-Dade County. The U.S. Supreme Court has allowed the Trump administration's ban on most migrants seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border to take effect while legal challenges against it proceed. Wednesday's order overturns a federal appeals court injunction against Trump's policy, which bars migrants from seeking asylum in the United States unless they've first applied for refugee status in the countries they pass through on their way to the U.S. Two justices, Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, dissented, with Sotomayor writing, quote, although this nation has long kept its doors open to refugees, and although the stakes for asylum seekers could not be higher, the government implemented its rule without first providing the public notice and inviting the public input generally required by law. On Capitol Hill, two young immigrants testified Wednesday that the Trump administration's move to deport non-citizens with medical conditions is a virtual death sentence. The pair told the House Oversight Committee they were abruptly ordered by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services this month to leave the U.S. within 33 days, even though they've lived in the United States for years under a program that defers deportations for immigrants who would otherwise not have access to life-saving treatment. This is Massachusetts Democratic Congressmember Ayanna Pressley.
The occupant of this White House and his xenophobic administration cannot reach any new lows. They go even lower, deciding to give seriously ill children and their families 33 days to leave the country or risk being deported.
Testifying Wednesday was 24-year-old Maria Isabel Bueso, who has a rare genetic disorder known as MPS. Bueso was brought to the U.S. from Guatemala at the age of 7 to seek treatment. She told lawmakers her participation in a clinical trial in California saved her life and led to the first and only treatment for the disease. Meanwhile, 16-year-old Jonathan Sanchez, who has cystic fibrosis, testified his life was saved at the age of 12 when his parents brought him from Honduras for treatment in Boston.
The day our lawyers told us that the medical deferred action program was canceled, I started crying and telling my mom, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. If I go back to Honduras, I will die.
The Trump administration's medical deportation order this month came without any advance notice or public announcement. After it sparked a backlash from immigrant rights groups, medical professionals, Democratic lawmakers, officials partially backtracked and said they would, quote, reopen previously pending cases for consideration, unquote. However, it's unclear what the longer-term fate of the program will be. In Illinois, a 37-year-old Mexican man became the eighth immigrant in less than a year to die after being jailed by U.S. immigration officials. That's according to BuzzFeed News, which reports the unnamed man died in a local hospital after he was jailed by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, September 3rd at the McHenry County Adult Correctional Facility in Woodstock, Illinois. At the U.S. southern border, the first immigration court hearings of Trump's so-called Remain in Mexico program began Wednesday in large tents in Laredo and Brownsville, Texas. The program has forced more than 42,000 people who sought asylum at the border to wait in Mexico until their court dates. Judges in the tent courts conducted hearings via video teleconference, and lawyers reported multiple technical glitches. Immigration courts are usually open to the public, but officials denied access to reporters and residents who were there to observe. Meanwhile, many asylum seekers waiting in Mexico say they face kidnapping and extortion as the government there has failed to provide promised humanitarian aid. Purdue Pharma has reached a tentative proposed settlement with a number of state, local, and tribal governments over the company's role in fueling the U.S. opioid crisis. Under emerging details of the settlement, the Sackler family, which owns Purdue, would personally pay $3 billion in cash, plus another $1.5 billion after the pending sale of a subsidiary company is completed. Purdue would then declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy and dissolve before reforming to continue selling pharmaceuticals, including the opioid OxyContin. Profits would be used to pay plaintiffs. Some prosecutors have vowed to oppose the deal. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro said in a statement, quote, "This apparent settlement is a slap in the face to everyone who's had to bury a loved one due to this family's destruction and greed. It allows the Sackler family to walk away billionaires and admit no wrongdoing," the Pennsylvania Attorney General said. President Trump says the Food and Drug Administration is poised to remove flavored e-cigarettes from the market. Trump made the announcement in an Oval Office meeting Wednesday morning with Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar.
We can't allow people to get sick, and we can't have our youth be so affected. And I'm hearing it, and that's how the First Lady got involved. She's got a son together that is a beautiful young man, and she feels very, very strongly about it. She's seen it. We're both reading it. A lot of people are reading it. But people are dying with vaping.
The FDA's decision to ban flavored e-cigarettes comes after a sixth person died in the U.S. from a mysterious lung disease tied to vaping. In Syria, Turkish officials are calling for an immediate ceasefire in the northwestern province of Idlib, warning that a Syrian and Russian assault on the country's last major opposition-held enclave could create a catastrophe rivaling all others in the nearly eight-year-old conflict. Turkey's call came as UN investigators said U.S.-led forces may have carried out war crimes in Syria. In a report released Wednesday, the investigation found that during a U.S.-led assault on ISIS, quote, international coalition forces failed to employ the necessary precautions to discriminate adequately between military objectives and civilians, unquote. The UN also found Russian and Syrian forces may have committed war crimes by intentionally targeting civilian sites, including hospitals and clinics, schools, farmland, and markets. In Colombia, another candidate in the municipal elections has been killed. Hernando Orly Garcia Vasquez, who was running for mayor in the region of Antioquia, was shot 13 times over the weekend in the city of Medellin. This comes just weeks after mayoral candidate Karina Garcia was brutally murdered, along with at least four others, while campaigning in the Cauca region. The skyrocketing violence triggered Colombia's human rights ombudsman to warn earlier this week that more than half of Colombia is at risk of violence related to the upcoming local elections. Also in Colombia, human rights activist Yunir Moreno was shot to death in his home in the rural region of Cauca on Sunday. Two other indigenous women activists were also killed in recent days in the region of Cauca. Republican lawmakers in North Carolina voted Wednesday to override Governor Roy Cooper's veto of the state budget in a surprise vote that was rammed through with barely half of the state representatives present. Democrats say they were tricked by their Republican colleagues, who promised there would be no votes during Wednesday morning session of North Carolina's House of Representatives in order to allow lawmakers to attend 9/11 memorial services. As the vote was called, one of the few remaining Democrats on the floor, State Representative Deb Butler, led a protest.
You shall not do this to democracy in North Carolina, Mr. Speaker. How dare you do this, Mr. Speaker? I will not yield.
We're not going to let anybody touch
her. I will not yield, Mr. Speaker.
North Carolina State Representative Butler refused to yield the floor for several minutes, even as Republicans ordered her microphone cut off and as uniformed police entered the House chamber. The measure ultimately passed on a vote of 52-9, with 56 lawmakers absent. Last June, North Carolina Governor Cooper vetoed North Carolina's budget, saying its Republican authors sought to underpay teachers while rejecting federal dollars to expand the state's Medicaid program. In a statement condemning Wednesday's surprise vote, Cooper accused Republicans of exploiting the 9/11 anniversary for political purposes.
On a day when tragedy united our country, we should be standing together despite party. But instead, Republicans pulled their most deceptive stunt yet.
Republicans hoping to override the governor's veto still need a supermajority in the North Carolina State Senate. The Republican state representative who called the motion for Wednesday morning's vote, Jason Sane, defended his action, saying, quote, "As a former firefighter and an American, I'm appalled that anyone in our country would stop going about their normal business on this day. When we stop being a beacon of freedom, hope and democracy, then the terrorists win," he said. In Washington, D.C., families of passengers who died in the crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 marked the six-month anniversary of the disaster by demanding the FAA deny Boeing a recertification of its 737 MAX airliner. All 157 people aboard the Ethiopian Airlines flight were killed after the plane's software put it into a dive that the pilots were unable to recover from. The disaster followed another crash of a Boeing 737 MAX plane less than 5 months earlier, which killed all 189 people aboard a Lion Air flight off the coast of Indonesia. Clarice Moore, whose 24-year-old daughter Danielle was killed in the Ethiopian crash, joined a protest Tuesday outside the Transportation Department's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
I got robbed. We all got robbed because this is preventable accident. It is not an accident. They should have ground the plane after the first crash. Instead, knowing it has a flaw, yet they let it fly and took away one of the most important persons in our lives.
The vigil was organized in part by Nadja Milleron, whose daughter Samia Stumo was killed in the crash. Samia's great-uncle is Ralph Nader. Her grandmother is UC Berkeley anthropologist Laura Nader. And in Mexico, renowned artist and activist Francisco Toledo died last Thursday at his home in Oaxaca City. He was 79 years old. Toledo's artwork and activism drew global attention to the indigenous traditions of his home state of Oaxaca in southern Mexico, one of the poorest regions of Mexico. Mexico. Toledo, who is widely known as El Maestro, the teacher, was a painter, photographer, sculptor, and ceramicist who tirelessly defended the authentic Oaxacan indigenous traditions. His father was a Zapotec shoemaker. In 2002, when McDonald's announced plans to build a fast food restaurant in the nearly 500-year-old town square in the heart of Oaxaca City, Toledo threatened to protest naked at the site. Instead, he led a protest with hundreds of people chanting, "Tamales, yes, hamburgers, no," as Toledo gave out free tamales. Friend and filmmaker David Riker mourned the loss of Toledo. In a statement, he said, quote, "In an age when celebrity has become an end to itself, Toledo offered a radical alternative what an artist can be. Immensely successful, he never enriched himself. Instead, he donated everything he had to create free and open spaces throughout the city, art centers, libraries, and museums." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We begin today's show looking at President Trump's ousting of John Bolton, his hawkish national security adviser. Bloomberg is reporting Bolton's firing came after he opposed a proposal to ease sanctions on Iran and for Trump to possibly meet with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani later this month on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. Bolton has long been a fierce critic of diplomacy. He'd strongly pushed for Trump to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal. He also opposed negotiations with North Korea, as well as with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And he was a key supporter of the attempted U.S.-backed coup in Venezuela and an advocate of regime change in Cuba and Nicaragua.
On Wednesday, President Trump made his first televised remarks about Bolton's ouster. He repeatedly criticized Bolton's support for the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
And, you know, John wasn't in line with what we were doing. And actually, in some cases, he thought it was too tough what we were doing. Mr. Tough Guy, you know, you have to go into Iraq. Going into Iraq was something that he felt very strongly about. So we're right now in for over $7 trillion into the Middle East. And I don't say it was his decision. You had a president and you had other people also, but he was very out there, I can tell you. We were set back very badly when John Bolton talked about the Libyan model, and he made a mistake. And as soon as he mentioned that, the Libyan model, what a disaster. Take a look at what happened to Gaddafi with the Libyan model. And he's using that to make a deal with North Korea. And I don't blame Kim Jong-un for what he said after that. And he wanted nothing to do with John Bolton. And that's not a question of being tough. That's a question of being not smart to say something like that.
John Bolton becomes the third national security adviser to be ousted by President Trump so far. Trump is expected to announce a replacement next week. We're joined now by Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written several books, including most recently Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. We thank you very much, Phyllis, for being with us. Why don't you talk about John Bolton's role during the Trump administration and before?
One of the things about John Bolton that I think is so crucially important is his absolute consistent commitment to militarism. This is a man who does not believe in diplomacy anywhere. He does not believe there are any international crises that can be solved by anything other than direct military intervention, whether it's sending troops, whether it's bombing. His op-ed in the Wall Street Journal calling for a first strike against North Korea, his consistent years of calling for bombing Iran, his calls for regime change in Venezuela, most recently, of course, his opposition to even negotiating with the Taliban in Afghanistan, let alone a partial small-scale troop withdrawal. All of this is of a piece. All of this is a consistent position that says America first means America military first and only. So this has been a consistent pattern that, of course, helped to lead to the Iraq War. Ironically, it doesn't happen very often. President Trump was right in how he described Bolton's role as a major, not just a major cheerleader, but somebody who actually orchestrated some of the things that made possible the U.S. war in Iraq back in 2003. Specifically, it was Bolton who at that time was, again, a bit ironically, the Deputy Secretary of State for Arms Control and Disarmament Affairs. He arranged to have the director of the UN's Chemical Weapons Watchdog Agency, the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons, Jose Bustani, he arranged his firing on the basis that Bustani was trying to get Iraq to join the anti-chemical weapons organization so it would be obligated to have even more direct inspections throughout the country to prove that, indeed, there was no chemical weapons program, there was no weapons of mass destruction program. And instead of allowing that to go forward to prevent the possibility of war, Bolton got him fired so that he could install somebody who would refuse to allow it. He tried to do the same thing with the director of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Mohammed al-Baradei, when al-Baradei had the temerity to actually testify to the Security Council that, no, Iraq did not have a viable nuclear weapons program. And in response, Bolton tried to get him fired, but he failed on that account. But he has consistently worked around the administrations he's worked for with one goal, which is the deploying of military force by the United States, not in the interest of nation building, democratization. He doesn't even talk like a neocon in that sense. His goal is purely military, and that's been a consistent position.
Well, Phyllis, as you say, there's ample evidence, as you've outlined, his positions were by no means a secret. So why do you think Trump appointed him in the first place, and why sack him now?
Well, I think the appointment had less to do with his strategic commitment to militarism than to the fact that he had spent a year or so on Fox News praising President Trump. And we know that's what motivates Trump to want to bring people into the administration, those who praise him on TV. That's what Bolton was doing to get into that position. Secondly, we should be very clear that while there are these differences between Trump and Bolton, Trump is by no means opposed to U.S. military assaults. The notion that he was against the war in Iraq is simply false. The notion that he did not want to ever use military force, simply not true. He just had a different view on some of these specific issues than Bolton had, and he has a very short memory, as we know. So I think he either had forgotten or really didn't care that in the past there had been this consistent Bolton pattern of calling for more military force than Trump might have chosen at any given moment. But in the case that we see now, why was he ousted? I think it was primarily cumulative. There were some specific events in the recent period. One, of course, was the negotiations with the Taliban, which Bolton had strongly opposed. He had wanted the U.S. to remain as a major military power in Afghanistan for the indefinite future. And when these negotiations were underway, and particularly when the negotiations looked like they were succeeding after almost a year with Bolton's former replacement at the United Nations, Zalmay Khalilzad, in charge of those negotiations, it looked like there was agreement on what we might call step one of a process in Afghanistan, which would have meant the United States pulling out most of its troops, even though there was likely to be a continuing war. The U.S. would be out of that equation, which would significantly lessen the numbers of civilian casualties in Afghanistan that are primarily because of U.S. and U.S.-backed airstrikes. That was not going to be allowed to happen if John Bolton had his way. So that was one of the big parts of the impetus for the immediate part. We're now hearing that there's also the possibility that there were negotiations underway with Iran for the possibility of talks between Trump and President Rouhani on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, which meets in a couple of weeks in New York. I don't know if those reports are true. There are often these kinds of reports as ways of just testing the waters to see what the response might be. But certainly, the Iranians have made clear that if there was an easing of sanctions, and not before, they are very eager for new talks with the United States and anyone else, particularly with the former signatories of the Iran nuclear deal. So all of these things were underway just in recent weeks. But I would say that the overall decision of Trump to get rid of his national security advisor had more to do with the consistency of these disagreements and the fact that Bolton had no compunctions about going on television and condemning the policies of his boss. And Trump does not like to be upstaged on television.
Well, let's go back to November 2018 when Bolton characterized Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. We'll say Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua as a, quote, troika of tyranny.
The troika of tyranny in this hemisphere, Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, has finally met its match. This troika of tyranny, this triangle of terror stretching from Havana to Caracas to Managua, is the cause of immense human suffering, the impetus of enormous regional instability, and the genesis of a sordid cradle of communism in the Western Hemisphere.
Let's go back to President Trump speaking yesterday.
So we'll see what happens. No, I disagreed with John Bolton on his attitudes on Venezuela. I thought he was way out of line. And I think I've proven to be right. But we are always watching Venezuela very, very closely.
So, Phyllis Bennett, should we expect a change in policy here? Or was John Bolton very much representing what Trump feels in this area? And where does Pompeo fit into this picture, of course, his nemesis now being talked about as possibly replacing him but remaining as Secretary of State? The only time that was ever done in history was with Henry Kissinger under Nixon, doing both NSA, National Security Advisor, and Secretary of State.
Right. On the question of Venezuela, I think there's no question that at the time that the U.S. launched its massive escalation of sanctions against Venezuela that have had such a devastating impact on the people of Venezuela, there was no question that President Trump agreed and was eager to impose those sanctions. Where he seems to have had a disagreement with Bolton was on how easy it might be to carry out a U.S.-backed coup. The U.S. was very involved in supporting the attempted coup by Guaido, the opposition leader who the U.S., President Trump, had been very eager to recognize as the supposedly legitimate leader of Venezuela. And it turned out, of course, that that so-called coup failed. It did not get support from the military in Venezuela. And what we hear is that Bolton had promised Trump, very much in the language of what people promised President Bush during the run-up to the war in Iraq, it will be a cakewalk. It'll be easy. We can do this without any problem. Turned out it didn't work. And while the conditions in Venezuela remain very, very tough for the Venezuelan population, and there are huge political challenges both to the diminished support for the opposition and increasing opposition to the elected leadership of Venezuela. What we're now seeing is that Trump is singling out this one area where he had a disagreement with Bolton and implying that somehow that was a disagreement on the entire range of Venezuela policies. I don't think we can expect a serious transformation of that policy in the form of withdrawing those crippling sanctions, for instance. Unfortunately, I think what we will see is a stasis position. We will leave in place, Trump will say, these sanctions that are in place now, we won't go any further towards a military coup or direct military intervention, but we will leave in place these very dramatically devastating sanctions that are having such a crippling impact on the economy in Venezuela. On the question of Pompeo, I think what we're seeing is that Pompeo has been very successful as Secretary of State in anticipating the trajectory of where Trump is likely to want to go and getting out ahead of that position and, in fact, then turning to his boss and saying, I think we should do X, hoping, and in most cases, it seems he's got a good sense of what Trump might want to do, Trump saying, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's go in that direction. Pompeo doesn't seem to be basing his positions on any level of principle, any sort of consistent foreign policy, other than making his boss happy. So in that context, although there are a half a dozen or so people being touted as possibilities to replace Bolton as the national security advisor, it's certainly possible that Trump may simply throw up his hands and say, hey, this guy seems okay. He likes me. I like him because he likes what I like. let's just keep him around. That's a definite possibility.
Yeah, so let's go to the question of Bolton's successor. In an editorial Tuesday, the New York Times said it's not likely to matter much given Trump's chaotic approach to foreign policy. The Times said the president's naming of Bolton as national security advisor in March 2018 was itself, quote, an instance of Trumpian chaos. Trump wanted to pursue an end to hostilities in Korea and Afghanistan and proved wary of conflict in Iran and Venezuela. Yet he chose a proponent of belligerence who disdains diplomacy, supports allies be damned unilateralism, and thinks bombing North Korea and Iran is the best way to neutralize their nuclear threat, the New York Times wrote. Meanwhile, Democratic Senator Chris Murphy said in a statement, quote, no one of any quality is going to take a job in the nation's national security cabinet so long as everyone's head is permanently hovering slightly above the chopping block. Phyllis Bennis, your assessment of what's been said and who you think will actually replace Bolton and if it'll make a difference.
Well, I think this question of what Chris Murphy said, that no one of quality, it depends how you define quality. If you define quality as people who are looking to get higher on the hierarchical ladders of the Washington foreign policy establishment, there's plenty of people out there who would do it. It could be Bolton's former deputy, who's right now the acting national security advisor. This is a position that's going to have very little power. We see that, in fact, with Bolton. Bolton had the president's ear, and he was able to get his ideas into Trump's mind. But on some of these key issues where there were these tactical disagreements, we did not see his position prevailing, because while the title is National Security Advisor, for a president who doesn't take advice, that doesn't have a huge amount of influence. We should be very careful, though, not to get into the assumption that Trump somehow represents a diplomatically based foreign policy. Trump is as scornful of diplomacy, of real diplomacy, as Bolton is. The difference is Trump sees diplomacy as a way where he can promote himself as a great showman, as the leader who's made possible all these things that nobody else could pull off. I stepped foot into North Korea. I shook hands with the North Korean leader. This is the kind of circus that he wants to be able to carry out. That was the basis for wanting the Taliban to come to Camp David. It wasn't because there were unresolved issues in the negotiations that he thought last-minute talks could solve. It was because he wanted to preside over this very dramatic, world-altering ceremony. So this is very much a symbolic set of positions. I think what is true, and what has been relatively consistent with Trump, is that he doesn't think it's worth it to deploy large numbers of U.S. troops abroad when there's no discernible interest politically for him or for what something he can claim for U.S. policy. The notion that he is somehow concerned about what happened, for example, to Muammar Gaddafi, who was, of course, captured and tortured to death by opposition forces backed by NATO and the United States in a NATO intervention that was carried out somewhat reluctantly, but regardless of that, by President Obama at the behest and the urging of Hillary Clinton, this was a horrific end to that regime. And the notion that President Trump somehow is concerned about what happened to Gaddafi rather than what happened to U.S. credibility around the world that again took a dive because it was seen by so many around the world as carrying out this absolutely illegal intervention and bombing campaign in which so many people died and so many people continue to die in Libya, creating an enormous set of humanitarian crises that include a refugee crisis. It's just set in motion a regional disaster across North Africa and the Middle East. I don't think President Trump is concerned about that.
Phyllis Bennis, we're going to ask you to stay with us as we move on to our next subject. Phyllis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, serving on the National Board of Jewish Voice for Peace, written a number of books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. When we come back, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has vowed to annex a third of the occupied West Bank. Phyllis Bennis is staying with us and will be joined by the Palestinian human rights attorney, legal scholar Noura Arakat as well. Stay with us.
I could hardly believe it when I heard the news today. I had to come and get it straight from you. You said you were leaving, someone swept your heart away from the look.
Michael Bolton singing, How Am I Supposed to Live Without You? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing worldwide condemnation for vowing to annex nearly a third of the occupied West Bank if he wins next week's snap election. The United Nations, the Arab League, the European Union, and Russia have all criticized Netanyahu's plan, which he unveiled Tuesday.
Today I'm announcing my intention to apply with the formation of the next government, Israeli sovereignty, on the Jordan Valley and northern Dead Sea.
Netanyahu's pledge comes just a week before Israeli voters return to the polls on Tuesday for new elections after Netanyahu failed to form a coalition government following Israel's April 9th election. Netanyahu's annexation plan would crush hopes of an eventual Palestinian state. Longtime Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat said the move would add to Israel's long history of violating international law.
What Prime Minister Netanyahu said tonight about asking his people for a mandate to allow that will enable him to annex the Jordan Valley is paramount to a war crime. Annexation of occupied territories is a war crime.
Well, for more, we're joined by Noura Arakat, Palestinian human rights attorney, legal scholar, assistant professor at Rutgers University. Her new book is titled Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. And Phyllis Bennis is still with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, written a number of books, including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Noura Arakat, let's go to you first in Montreal. If you could talk about, just respond to what the prime minister, who knows how long he will be prime minister, said if he wins, he will annex a third of the West Bank.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me this morning. First of all, I think it's important to point out, as you have, that one third of the West Bank is the Jordan Valley. It's the site of the richest sources of water, some of the richest sources of water in the West Bank, including the Jordan River Basin and the Dead Sea, as well as numerous springs. The World Bank has said that if Palestinians actually have access to these lands, it could be their Palestinian breadbasket, increasing their agricultural yield by $1.6 million annually. We are talking about a rich area where Palestinian farmers, where Palestinians cannot access for leisure, for livelihood, for home. And this is what's at stake. The other thing to point out is that there's already de facto annexation. A lot of attention is being placed on Netanyahu as he makes more bold and racist claims to his constituent base ahead of elections. But it's important to know that this is not about Netanyahu. This isn't even about the Israeli right. This is Israeli policy. In the aftermath of the 1967 war, Israel declared 60% of the Jordan Valley as a closed military zone and off basis. They built three outposts, military outposts in 1968, and under a labor government, built those into civilian settlements in the early 1970s. It was a labor Israeli Labor Minister Yigal Alon, who declared that the Jordan Valley would be part of Israel's defensible borders. It was Israel's Dove, Yitzhak Rabin, in 1995, who said that this would be part of Israel's final borders. And it was under the Oslo peace process that 90% of the Jordan Valley came under full Israeli civil and military control. What Netanyahu is doing now is basically taking this awful policy, this steady policy of settler colonial removal of Palestinian and encroachment of Palestinian lands to its logical end, which is to say, well, now it's just ours. And it's really disingenuous and dishonest to be angry with Netanyahu and his bold claims against international law and what is tantamount to a war crime, and not be angry with the fact that U.S. foreign policy has steadily created this fact on the ground, that the EU now, as it's condemned Netanyahu and said that it won't recognize these moves, still fails to apply sanctions in order to punish this policy, in order to deter it, where there's no condemnation of the fact. Everybody wants to talk about the two-state solution that's been dead, but nobody's paying attention to the fact that since 1967, the Palestinian population in the Jordan Valley has been reduced from 320,000 in 1967 to 60,000 today. And most of those 60,000 are concentrated in Jericho, which is the Palestinian Bantustan in the Jordan Valley. So This is unfortunate, but it's also really disingenuous not to discuss it in the length and in the context of what has been steady Israeli policy and steady U.S. policy and international policy that has made it possible.
Well, Noura, as you said, there has already been a de facto annexation. But could you explain why what Netanyahu is proposing will definitively put an end to any possible two-state solution? And explain the geography, where the Jordan Valley and the northern Dead Sea, where they fall within the West Bank, and what Israeli formal annexation would mean for that area.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the Jordan Valley, 30% of the West Bank, is located on the easternmost border of the Palestine, Israel, and borders the Jordan River and the Dead Sea, which Palestinians have not had access to. What I mean by de facto annexation is that since 1967, Israel has declared that 60% of this area is a closed military zone, which means that Palestinians can't be on it, they can't dig into water wells, they cannot access the water for agriculture, even for their own drinking purposes. Right now, the settlers that live there, approximately 11,000 settlers, have access to six times as much water as the Palestinians. Israel has also declared 26 nature preserves. This is greenwashing, where they basically said these lands we're going to preserve for nature purposes, but that really just means that Palestinians can't be on those lands as they continue to build up settlements. The settlements now in the Jordan Valley, the 37 settlements, 11,000 settlers, stand over one of the most productive settlement industries of agribusiness, the palm date industry, and so on and so forth, that should be the object of boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns. So what I mean by de facto annexation is that, as a matter of fact, Palestinians can't live there, they can't go there, they can't produce, they cannot have livelihood. Now, as a matter of law, Israel is basically telling the world, listen, we're going to stop the sham. It's just going to become part of Israel. We'll make it a fact on the ground, and it'll be part of what we call the defensible borders that Palestinians will have to accept. And under the framework of the peace process, that's exactly what the arrangement is. Israel has steadily taken the land, and because none of the peace process is regulated by any international law or by multilateralism, but instead is brokered by the U.S., which is Israel's primary ally, they can then establish that all the land that they take is theirs when they come back to the negotiating table and then say, Palestinians, you must accept this or take nothing. That's why this is, yes, a war crime. Yes, this is really disheartening. Yes, this is horrible. But this is also the logical end of a policy that we have stood by and watched. And instead of discussing this as settler colonial removal instead of discussing this as apartheid and racial discrimination, we have discussed this as a question of sovereignty and a question of negotiations in two states where the objective facts on the ground lead that there has not been a Palestinian state, that there will not be a Palestinian state. What Israel has wanted since 1967 and articulated in the Alon plan and now brought to fruition is that Palestinians will be in semi-autonomous regions where they can govern themselves in Bantustans, and Israel will control the rest of their lives around them. And that's what we're seeing.
Earlier this year, the Trump administration recognized Israeli sovereignty over the occupied Golan Heights in a reversal of decades of U.S. policy and in defiance of international law. Netanyahu later unveiled plans to build a new settlement named Trump Heights in the area to thank President Trump for his decision. And then during a televised address in May, Netanyahu held up an updated State Department map of Israel signed by President Trump. Next to the map, the word "nice" was written with an arrow pointing to the Golan Heights shown as part of Israel. Netanyahu said the map was a gift from Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner. Israel annexed the Golan Heights in 1981 after capturing the territory from Syria during the 67 war. Nur Erekat, if you could respond to the significance of all of this.
I'm very glad you brought that up, because here we have the Jordan Valley, which Israel has created a legal fiction about that there is no sovereign and used its legal strategies in order to basically say that they can negotiate it and use the peace process and its alliance with the U.S. to take these Palestinian lands steadily and surely to fulfill a vision of greater Israel. But the Golan Heights is different. There is no controversy over the fact that this is Syrian sovereign territory. There is no controversy over the fact that it should be returned to Syria. And yet we saw blatantly, Israel declared its sovereignty over the Golan Heights in contravention of international opinion, international law, a clear war crime. There's nothing to be discussed. And despite all of the condemnations, despite all of the law on the side of the international communities, including the draft articles of state responsibility, which puts a responsibility on third state parties in order to react to this egregious maneuver, nothing has been done. Nothing has been done besides non-recognition, which should tell us that much of what's going on in this region from the international community, and not just from the Trump administration and decades of U.S. administrations, is a lot of theater and political theater around the Middle East, but very little political will to act. Right now, there should be political will to act, to impose sanctions, to support boycott, divestment, and sanctions. When Netanyahu came to Congress in 2011 in order to sabotage Obama's Iran rapprochement deal, he also said that he was going to keep the Jordan Valley. And Congress gave him 27 standing ovations. And now Congress, which continues this legacy of being part of the problem, is proposing a bill that would criminalize BDS, nonviolent protest in the United States, rather than reverse this course and actually hold Israel to account. So we can participate in the political theater of what Israel is trying, what Netanyahu is doing and promising to his constituent base, and have discussions about Greenblatt and Kushner and now Avi Berkowitz. But this is all a distraction. The facts on the ground are that Palestinians are living in segregation, in reservations. They cannot even access the Dead Sea for leisure. Can you imagine living near this, the Dead Sea, which people from all over the world travel to, and you cannot access it because you're Palestinian? You can't float in the water because you're Palestinian. So we're talking about an apartheid system, a settler colonial context that we're not addressing. Well,
finally, Phyllis Bennis, we just wanted to bring you in. Nur Erekat just referred to Avi Berkowitz, and I wanted to get a quick comment from you on the snap election that's coming up, Benny Gantz, the lieutenant general, versus Netanyahu, and the fact that the White House has just announced that the new Middle East peace envoy is going to be 30-year-old White House administrative assistant Avi Berkowitz. He is replacing Jason Greenblatt, Trump's former real estate lawyer. Let's see, what did former White House spokesperson Hope Hicks previously describe Berkowitz's duties as? Daily logistics like getting coffee and coordinating meetings. As we wrap up, just the significance of all of this right now.
I think Nora's point is very important, that who is playing these various roles doesn't matter very much. Avi Berkowitz is not just ignorant about diplomacy. He also was educated partly at a right-wing yeshiva, nationalist yeshiva in Israel. So this is, you know, this is a consistent piece. I think the more important point, again, that from what Noura was talking about in terms of the changes that are afoot in the United States, where there are some possibilities now, not yet Congress, but the shift in public discourse, the shift in media discourse about the question of Palestinian rights is a massive shift that's underway, and things may become possible in the future. What's been different with President Trump in office, the blatant nature of his recognition. No one before was willing to say that the U.S. recognizes or doesn't mind that Israel is occupying the Golan Heights. His official recognition of it did bring expressions of opposition. That gives us a way in to build that challenge, to build the movements for Palestinian rights in this country that says that it's not okay for the U.S. to remain as the enabler of this kind of settler colonialism, this kind of apartheid, the kind of occupation that the U.S. has indeed supported all these years. It is different when you have a U.S. official position recognizing Jerusalem as the sole capital of Israel. That's going to be much harder for future presidents to reverse. So it does become important when it's official. But it also means that there's more people willing to say, wait a minute, this is not okay. It was all right that we stayed silent while this expulsion of Palestinians from their land continues. But when we do it officially, we have to stand up and say, no, that's not okay. So this is a moment of opportunity. The Israeli elections are not likely to change very much. The opposition, Benny Gantz, a former general whose campaign was based on a helicopter trip over devastated Gaza in 2014, where he commanded the troops that were responsible for the deaths of 2,200 Palestinians in that 50-day attack. That's the basis of his campaign. So he's no peacenik running against Netanyahu. But it does give us an opportunity here in the United States to change the congressional and the political calculus as they become forced to realize in Congress that their voters, their base, their constituents are massively changing their position.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Phyllis Bennis, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, serves on the National Board of Jewish Voice for Peace. Noura Erekat, joining us from Montreal, Palestinian human rights attorney and legal scholar. When we come back, we look at Newark's growing water crisis, where thousands remain unable to drink the tap water due to lead contamination. Stay with us.
Love will find you in the end. You'll find out just who was your friend. Don't be sad, I know you will. But don't give up until true love find you in the end. This is a promise.
True love will find you in the end, by the songwriter and visual artist Daniel Johnston. He died on Wednesday at the age of 58. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show with the water crisis in Newark, New Jersey, where thousands of residents remain unable to drink their tap water in an enduring public health nightmare. Lead contamination has plagued the city for years, but lead levels have spiked even higher in 2019. The crisis recently came to a head following revelations that water filters distributed to residents may not have been effective. The news came in August when the Environmental Protection Agency ordered Newark officials to distribute bottled water to 15,000 residents, saying water filters were not fully shielding thousands of homes from lead exposure. Newark residents waited in line for hours to receive their water. The city then stopped handing out the bottles after discovering many of them had exceeded their best by date.
Newark's the largest city in New Jersey with nearly 300,000 residents. Its water crisis primarily affects its poor and black community. In 2017, more than 13% of New Jersey children with elevated lead levels were in Newark, despite just 3.8% of the state's children living there. Well, for more, we're joined here in New York by Yvette Jordan, a teacher at Newark Central High and resident of Newark South Ward. And in Chicago, Illinois, we're joined by Eric Olson, a top official at the Natural Resources Defense Council, which filed a lawsuit against Newark over the summer, accusing it of violating federal safe drinking water laws. We want to thank you both for being with us. Eric, let's begin with you. Lay out the issue in Newark right now.
Well, basically, what we have is a public health crisis in Newark. Unfortunately, the lead levels in the drinking water in Newark are some of the highest in the country that have been recorded in recent years for any city. So basically, what's happening is bottled water is being distributed to some citizens in Newark because the filters didn't look like they were working. There's more tests going on to figure out why that's the case. But we've got a lot of people across the city, especially children, who are really put at risk. The best estimates from 2017 are that at least 700 kids in Newark have elevated blood lead levels. We don't know how much of that is from the drinking water. But the bottom line is that we've got real health risks in Newark, and we need to fix the problem. And the city has been pretty slow to getting around to taking action on it.
I mean, what is astounding about all of this is Flint. In a word, Flint. This country has been going through this for years. The Flint water poisoned. Yvette Jordan, you're a teacher at Central High. In fact, the principal who used to be the principal of Central High is now the mayor, Ross Baraka. Can you explain when you first learned that the water is lead contaminated and what you feel now needs to happen, what you were told, how the stories changed?
Well, initially in February of 2018, NRDC approached an organization I'm a part of, and that is New Caucus, which is Newark Education Workers Caucus. We are the plaintiff along with NRDC in the federal lawsuit. And they approached us and said, I don't know if you're aware, there is lead in the water in Newark. And actually, your numbers are rivaling Flint. So when we heard this, we were taken aback and extremely flabbergasted. So we said we had no idea. And they said, we're looking for a plaintiff and would you serve as this? So as educators, we said, absolutely. We were concerned about our students, of course, and residents of the city of Newark in general. And then I am a homeowner, so I was really concerned. Eventually, I had my home tested. I'm at 44.2 parts, which is almost three times the federal action level. So once we said we're filing, the mayor said everything is fine and there is no problem. So we were concerned about that, even though data showed there is one. And after the lawsuit was filed in June of 2018, he was still pushing back and saying it's not a problem. Finally, he acquiesced in October of 18 and said, okay, we will hand out filters. However, not filters for everybody. So that was a concern also. And as Eric alluded to, we are really concerned about pregnant women and children under six. So we're still concerned about that. So when the filters in only two filters seemingly failed, and the mayor said, okay, we are going to now hand out bottled water, only because there was an onslaught of attention and everybody saying, what is going on? Some people are getting the water now. And there's a lot of misinformation, and how it is managed is really still an area of concern. It's an area of concern for myself as an individual, as from New Caucus. Newark Water Coalition is extremely involved, and I saw footage earlier from their protest.
And can you talk about specifically, you said pregnant women and children under six, what mm-hmm. are the effects of lead?
And what is the city doing about them in particular?
Well, I think Eric, he's the expert there, and he can address that.
Eric.
I know as an educator, I know as an educator, though, I'm concerned about cognitive issues in my classroom, and I see that every day.
And Eric Olson, we just have 30 seconds, but what you're demanding of the city?
We're asking for immediate action to make sure that every citizen in Newark has safe drinking water, bottled water for people at risk, and filters if those work out. Secondly, they have to treat the water so it doesn't corrode the lead pipes and cause contamination. And finally, they need to pull out all those lead pipes, and we'd like to see some federal court oversight of that whole process so it doesn't fall off the radar once the press attention has reduce. We're very concerned about that.
We're going to do part two of the discussion, put it online at democracynow.org. And we also have to hope to have Mayor Ross Baraka on the show next week, the mayor of Newark. Eric Olson, I want to thank you for being with us. Top official at Natural Resources Defense Council. Please stay with us. And Yvette Jordan, Newark High School teacher, resident of Newark South Ward. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.